going to continue stepping through the book of Esther. And so you'd know by now that this is an unusual book of the Bible, namely because God is never mentioned. And that's intentional, right? You would know that by now. That's an intentional. It's actually a very clever technique that the author uses to draw your attention to the things that God is doing behind the scenes. So you're invited to look for God's providence here, this idea that God is supporting us and working through circumstances behind the scenes to bring about something good, to bring about a bigger purpose. And so we're set in a time where we have the Persian Empire, and the story itself is set in the city of Susa, and it follows two Jewish people, Esther and Mordecai, and it's their journey through a bunch of really unusual circumstances and what appears to be a whole bunch of interesting coincidences that happen. And so the story so far is to bring you back up to speed. Chapter one, we're introduced to Xerxes, who's the king of Persia, right? Someone who likes to show off his excessive wealth and his power, but who also is revealed to be very insecure, someone who really lacks wisdom. And you see that especially in the queen being deposed in chapter one there, the current queen. In chapter two, we meet Esther, one of the main characters of this story, who captivates the king and is very quickly crowned queen of Persia. In that chapter, we're also introduced to Mordecai, who overhears two guards plotting to murder the king, and through Esther, essentially saves the king's life by bringing that information to the king. In chapter three, we're introduced to Haman, one of the main villains of the story, a Persian official, and the king elevates him to one of the highest positions in the kingdom. And he demands that everyone kneel before him. But we see there that Mordecai chooses not to. He refuses to kneel before Haman, and that creates a lot of tension in the story. Haman, he's filled with rage when he finds out that Mordecai won't do this. And he also finds out that Mordecai is Jewish. And so he successfully persuades the king to enact this decree to kill the Jewish people. Chapter 4 then takes the story a bit further forward, and it focuses on Mordecai and Esther. And we see now that they're the only hope for the Jewish people in this situation. And they plan for Esther to reveal her Jewish identity to the king and ask that he reverse the decree. And what Simon, Pastor Simon, spoke about in communion this morning is this famous verse that we get here, where you'd recall from also last week's sermon that it prompts Mordecai to ask, you know, and to say to Esther, perhaps you've been made queen for such a time as this. And we know there's a risk involved, right? Approaching the king was not something just anyone could do. You needed to have a royal request. And so it was against Persian law to just turn up unannounced. And so Esther responds bravely to that by saying, if I must die, I must die. And so she decides to approach the king. And that's where Pastor Simon left us last Sunday. And so the tension in the story, it comes from not being told explicitly if God is at work behind the scenes or not. In all those remarkable events, God is not mentioned. And it makes us ask, what is God up to? Are all these events just coincidences? Or is there something else going on here behind the scenes? And as we get into chapters 5 and 6 today, there's a bit there to cover, but we'll see that we've come to a turning point in the story, one that allows us to look back on all those events that have happened so far and actually come to a conclusion about whether or not God is active in this story. So let's get into it. We're going to be starting with chapter 5, verse 1. It says this: on the third day of the fast, Esther put on her royal robes and entered the inner court of the palace. Just across from the king's hall, the king was sitting on his royal throne facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing there in the inner court, he welcomed her and held out the gold scepter to her. So Esther approached and touched the end of the scepter. And so Esther makes the decision here to approach the king. And it pays off. You know, she's welcomed in. But remember, you know, without that royal request, this was an act punishable by death. So as extreme as that sounds, that's how Xerxes ran his court. And also keep in mind here that We know Xerxes doesn't have a good reputation for treating his queens well. We saw that in chapter one. He's this very fickle, very deeply insecure person. And this took courage for Esther to do. Right? It's important to mention that it took courage for Esther to do that. In verse 3, it then says, "Then the king asked her, 'What do you want, Queen Esther? What is your request? I'll give it to you, even if it is half the kingdom.'" And so this confirms for us that Esther has found favor with the king, and the tension now moves from just wondering if Esther will survive this encounter to how she will use this opportunity. Right? And what's curious about this is that the king, without having heard this request, without knowing what it's about, he just straight up says, "Whatever you want, you can have it, you know, up to half the kingdom." And at this point in the story, we're expecting Esther just immediately reveal Haman's plot. But instead, she says this. She says, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a banquet I have prepared for the king." So this is interesting. Esther delays her request, right? Instead of just laying everything out then and there, Esther chooses patience. It seems like an unusual thing to do. So she hosts the king and Haman at a banquet, where she then makes a special request they both come to an even more exclusive banquet the next day. And that's exactly what they do. And so the significance of this is that Esther understands that having the right message is not enough. Timing is also really important. Timing matters. And so she doesn't just seek an audience with the king. She seeks the best opportunity to rescue her people, the best opportunity for her request to succeed with the king. And Haman, the villain of the story, he leaves this feast in high spirits. So jumping down to verse 9, it says this, "Haman was a happy man as he left the banquet. But when he saw Mordecai sitting at the palace gate, not standing up or trembling nervously before him, Haman became furious. However, he restrained himself and went on home." So remember here that from chapter 4 that Mordecai is at the gates of the palace because he's mourning. He's deeply upset about this news that Haman wants to destroy the Jewish people. So he's in mourning, but he's not allowed to go into the palace. He's not allowed to be anywhere near the presence of the king. This is one of those unusual ancient laws where you're not supposed to be sad or upset in the presence of royalty. And so he's there at the temple gate. And also remember from chapter 3 that everyone's expected to bow before Haman, right? And so Haman's coming out. He sees Mordecai at the gate. But what he sees is that Mordecai refuses again to bow before him. And this makes him furious. And so curiously, especially I think for someone of Haman's status and power, he doesn't immediately punish Mordecai, right? He restrains himself. And he goes home and he just complains to his wife and his friends about what he's just experienced. All right, that's a curious thing for him to do, for someone of his status and power. And so he goes home and complains to people, and this is what he says. We're going to skip past what he says, rather, and go to the advice he's given by his wife and his friend. Haman's wife, Zeresh, and all his friends suggested, "Set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall, and in the morning, ask the king to impale Mordecai on it. When this is done, you can go on your merry way to the banquet with the king." This pleased Haman, and he ordered the pole set up. And so to Haman, it's just that simple, right? You know, somebody disagrees with you, someone insults you, you just kill them, all right? That's what he does. That's what he wants to do. And in this, we see just how insecure Haman is. So the actions of one person could put him in such a bad mood is quite revealing. I think it shows us that Haman's joy, his identity, they're tied up in his status, right? It's very revealing. And when that's not recognized, everything comes crashing down. And so it doesn't matter that he has the favor of the king. It doesn't matter that he has this, you know, amazing status and position of power. He's just been invited to 2 exclusive banquets with the king and queen. Nothing of that matters anymore because one person wouldn't bow down to him. And so Haman orders that this tall stake be built, all right, so that Mordecai can be impaled on it in the morning. And this brings attention back in the story, right? It seems things can't get any worse for the Jews or Mordecai. So we're going to keep going into chapter 6, which is actually where we see a pivot in the story. This is where things suddenly start to change, right? So let's read through it together. This is chapter 6 now, verse 1. That night, the king had trouble sleeping, so he ordered an attendant to bring the book of the history of his reign so it could be read to him. In those records, he discovered an account of how Mordecai had exposed the plot of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the eunuchs who guarded the door to the king's private quarters. They had plotted to assassinate King Xerxes. What reward or recognition did we ever give Mordecai for this? The king asked. His attendants replied, nothing has been done for him. And so that night, the king can't sleep. So he has this account of his own reign read to him. And that kind of fits with what we know about Xerxes, someone who's really concerned about his own reputation and his achievements. But curiously, again, of all the volumes that could have been read to him, of all the chapters of that book that could have been open to, he just so happens to fall on that account of Mordecai's savior, really, of his revelation that the guards were plotting to kill the king. The king had totally forgotten about it. And at that same moment, it just so happens as well that Haman arrives at the palace. In chapter 4, it says, who is that in the outer court? The king inquired. As it happened, Haman had just arrived in the outer court of the palace to ask the king to impale Mordecai in a pole he had prepared. So the attendants replied to the king. Haman is out in the court. Bring him in, the king ordered. So Haman came in and the king said, what should I do to honor a man who truly pleases me? Haman thought to himself, whom would the king wish to honor more than me? So he replied, if the king wishes to honor someone, he should bring out one of the king's own royal robes, as well as a horse that the king himself has ridden, one with a royal emblem on its head. Let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials, and let him see that the man whom the king wishes to honor is dressed in the king's royal robes and led through the city square on the king's horse. Have the officials shout as they go, this is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. All right, so Haman doesn't know that the king has Mordecai in mind for this honor, right? Haman, he's so self-absorbed that he thinks this is about him. He thinks this is entirely about him. Haman craves this honor and recognition, and he has such a low opinion of other people that he completely misses what's happening here. And it's almost comical in a way, right? And what happens next is an ironic reversal. In verse 10, it says this. Excellent, the king said to Haman, quick, take the robes and my horse and do just as you have said for Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the gate of the palace. Leave out nothing you have suggested. What an amazing turn of events, right? Just as Haman enters the palace to request Mordecai's execution, the king orders him to honor Mordecai publicly for saving his life. And what follows is that Haman then leads Mordecai around the city on that royal horse, right? And it leaves Haman completely humiliated. And just like he did the last time he saw Mordecai, Haman goes back home and he tells his wife and his friends about it. Jumping down to verse 13, it says, when Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends what had happened, his wise advisors and his wife said, since Mordecai, this man who has humiliated you, is of Jewish birth, you will never succeed in your plans against him. It will be fatal to continue opposing him. And so I look at this, and this can only be described as an ironic reversal of their situation, you know, and it forms a significant turning point in the story. From this point onwards, we don't just see Haman's downfall, but we see Mordecai's rise to power. This is a significant moment in the book. And so as we're looking at all these events that have happened so far, this is what really stood out to me, that God's providence, this idea that he supports people and provides for them in the background, God's providence is often most visible in hindsight. Right? And as we've stepped through the book of Esther, we've been given a number of events that on their own seem like these unusual coincidences, or maybe just luck, right? But then we get to chapters 5 and 6, and that forms this turning point in the story where we're left doubting that luck has anything to do with it. And it's worth just laying it out for you. You know, just looking at chapters 5 and 6, I think we're given these 7 examples that are quite significant, which on the surface look like coincidences, but actually reveal the bigger picture at work. The first one there is this Esther finding favor with the king, right? Esther enters the throne room without being summoned, an act worthy of being put to death, and she finds favor with the king. That's amazing. The king's generous response then, on top of that, more than just listening to Esther, he eagerly welcomes her request. You know, he wants to know how he can help. But then Esther then delays her request. You know, the king is ready to listen, yet Esther doesn't make her request right away. At first, that seems unusual and maybe unnecessary, but looking back, the delay, it proves crucial, right? Because it allows two important things to happen. The king's sleepless night occurs, and Mordecai is honored before Esther exposes Haman. And that makes even more sense once you read the next chapter, chapter 7. So I'll say that for you, but keep that in the back of your mind, that the timing there is really important. Haman then restrains himself. You know, unusual, so unusual for someone of his status and power to not act immediately on someone who would disobey him. All right, the king's sleepless night. The king can't sleep. You know, it seems insignificant at first, but it leads to this account of his reign being read. And of all the books he could have read, of all the countless entries that there must be in those records, the forgotten act of Mordecai saving the king is what is read aloud. And not just at any time, but just as Haman arrives. Right? Haman arrives at exactly the right moment. On the exact night that Haman is planning Mordecai's death, the king is reminded of Mordecai's faithfulness. Right? That the timing there is perfect. Absolutely perfect. And the last one there, Haman honors Mordecai. All right, that ironic reversal of Haman having to honor Mordecai by parading him round the city on a horse is unbelievable. Right? You wouldn't have guessed that that would be the turn of events. And on top of that, the realization by Haman that it would be fatal to continue persecuting the Jewish people. And on their own, I don't think any one of those individual events looks supernatural. Right? They all have logical explanations for occurring. You know, from a human perspective, you're tempted to say things like, you know, perhaps the king was in a good mood when Esther entered the court. You know, perhaps Esther delayed her request because she was nervous. The king couldn't sleep because he's got so much on his mind. It's normal for a king. We can explain those away from a human perspective, but we're encouraged here to look at all of these things together. And this book is designed to make you wonder, is that a series of strange coincidences? Or is this God at work? Right? By the time you reach chapters 5 and 6, it becomes undeniable that something else is going on here. The story, it's full of these coincidences and ironic reversals, and the author of Esther is inviting us to consider their cumulative effect. Consider all of these things together at once. Those coincidences, they pile up until suddenly they look like providence. And in hindsight, we can see that this is God at work behind the scenes, working through imperfect people, but bringing about something for a greater purpose. He's bringing about something good. And none of those events on their own seem miraculous. But together, they changed history. And in hindsight, they show us that God's providence is everywhere. And so for you this morning, if God's providence is often most visible in hindsight, then this is an invitation for you to trust God even when your circumstances don't make sense. All right? If you're living through the events of chapter 5, or really any of the chapters before chapter 6, you would probably conclude that things were getting worse, not better. All right? Mordecai, he appears to be forgotten. Esther looks like she might miss her opportunity to make her request. Haman, he just appears unstoppable. Right? But once you read chapter 6, all of those things change. All those things change. And so for you this morning, these chapters, they're not saying that if you're a good person, that you're going to be publicly vindicated. It's not what it's about. Or that every injustice that you've experienced is going to be corrected in this lifetime. You shouldn't take that from this this morning, but rather it challenges the assumption that what you see today is the whole picture. But what you see today is the whole story. So this is a call to faith, you know, for you this morning to trust God even when your circumstances don't make sense. It's about acknowledging God, that he is at work behind the scenes throughout your life. You know, this doesn't necessarily remove the grief or the uncertainty that you might experience in this lifetime or that a situation might bring. Instead, this is about refusing to believe that your current situation is the whole story. So even if you see injustice prevailing in your life, even if you're just seeing that your own integrity is costing you dearly, maybe you're thinking that your prayers are going unanswered. You're thinking that you can't understand why God would allow these bad things to happen in the world and in your life personally. Why are they happening to me? I think these chapters in Esther are reminding us in a very clear way that God's silence is not God's absence. God's apparent silence is not his absence. And you can look at Mordecai. You know, he had no idea that while he slept, that the king was awake, that the king was being reminded of his faithfulness. It's being read aloud in the palace. He had no idea that God was already arranging the circumstances that would lead to his deliverance. Right? And in the same way, there might be things that God is doing right now that you cannot see. That's the message I want you to take this morning, that you know, there may be conversations taking place, hearts being softened, there's circumstances being arranged, opportunities being prepared, things that will only become much clearer later on. And the challenge for us is that we really want chapter 6 before we have to go through the events of chapter 5, right? We want to know how the story ends before we trust God with the next step. That's the challenge. But faith means trusting the author of the story even in the middle of the story. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I just want to thank you this morning for this amazing reminder in the book of Esther, Lord, that even when it looks like you're silent, Lord, even when it looks like you're not there in the background doing things, that Lord, you are. You're turning all these unusual events and circumstances into something good, Lord, into something that fulfills a greater purpose in our lives, Lord. As we think about how difficult that can be in our own lives to trust you, Lord, when we can't see the final ending of how things will turn out, Lord. And we ask that you'd be with us, that you would guide us, Lord, that you would help us to see that bigger picture, Lord, that you would help us, give us that peace and that confidence, give us that patience, like Esther, in the waiting, Lord, knowing the timing of when to act as well. We ask for those things in our lives, Lord, and we look to Jesus in this moment, Lord. And we know that God's providence, your providence, Lord, it's not an abstract doctrine, Lord. It's anchored in the cross, right? At the time of Jesus' crucifixion, it looked like evil had won, Lord. It looked like your promises had failed. It looked like hope was lost. We know, Lord, that you took that event and that became the very means of our salvation. What looked like defeat was actually your victory, Lord. And we look at that, Lord, and we say, if you can work through the darkest time in history to accomplish your great purpose, then we can trust you with the chapters of our lives, Lord. And we thank you for that blessing this morning. Amen.